Pharaoh's officials said to him, "How long will this man be a snare to us? Let the people go, so that they may worship the Lord their God. Do you not yet realize that Egypt is ruined?" Then Moses and Aaron were brought back to Pharaoh. "Go worship the Lord your God," he said, "but tell me who will be going." Moses answered, "We will go with our young, our old, with our sons and our daughters, and with our flocks and herds, because we are to celebrate a festival to the Lord." Pharaoh said, "The Lord be with you. If I let you go, along with your women and children, clearly you are bent on evil. No, have only the men go and worship the Lord, since that's what you have been asking for." Then Moses and Aaron were driven out of Pharaoh's presence. And the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over Egypt, so that locusts swarm over the land and devour everything growing in the fields, everything left by the hail." So Moses stretched out his staff over Egypt, and the Lord made an east wind blow across the land all that day and all that night. By morning, the wind had brought the locusts. They invaded all Egypt and settled down in every area of the country in great numbers. Never before had there been such a plague of locusts, nor will there ever be again. They covered all the ground until it was black. They devoured all that was left after the hail, everything growing in the fields and the fruit on the trees. Nothing green remained on tree or plant in the land of Egypt. Pharaoh quickly summoned Moses and Aaron and said, "I have sinned against the Lord your God and against you. Now forgive my sin once more and pray to the Lord your God to take this deadly plague away from me." Moses then left Pharaoh and prayed to the Lord. And the Lord changed the wind to a very strong west wind, which caught up the locusts and carried them into the Red Sea. Not a locust was left anywhere in Egypt. But the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he would not let the Israelites go. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand towards the sky, so that darkness spreads over Egypt, darkness that can be felt." So Moses stretched out his hand towards the sky, and total darkness covered all Egypt for 3 days. No one could see anyone else or move about for 3 days, yet all the Israelites had light in the places where they lived. Then Pharaoh summoned Moses and said, "Go worship the Lord. Even your women and children may go with you. Only leave your flocks and herds behind." But Moses said, You must allow us to have sacrifices and burnt offerings to present to the Lord our God. Our livestock too must go with us. Not a hoof is to be left behind. We have to use some of them in worshipping the Lord our God. And until we get there, we will not know what we are to use to worship the Lord." But the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he was not willing to let them go. Pharaoh said to Moses, "Get out of my sight. Make sure you do not appear before me again. The day you see my face, you will die." "Just as you say," Moses replied, "I will never appear before you again."
For those of you who are bleary-eyed still from watching the football last night, let me begin with what's generally acknowledged to be the greatest football film ever, that 1981 classic, Escape to Victory. England might need that. Famously, Escape to Victory features a number of real-life football stars, including Osvaldo Ardiles, Bobby Moore and Pelé, as well as many of the Ipswich team of the time, who, surprising as it now sounds to say it, were rather good. Escape to Victory is a feel-good film. But the setting is certainly not. The story's heroes are Allied prisoners of war in World War II, and the match that's the climax of the film is a propaganda stunt that is organized by their German captors. That's their agenda. The prisoners' agenda, on the other hand, is to escape. They are desperate to get away from their captivity and find their way to freedom. How they're going to do that is not at all obvious, at least not to begin with. But it is certainly their objective. Everything is stacked against them. Even the football match officials are outrageously biased. How does it end? Who, if anyone, will actually escape? Well, watch it and find out. But here in our story in Exodus, escape is also on the agenda. Escape for the prisoners, and actually also escape for us. Because this is not just ancient history, let alone fiction, let alone a movie. It has a powerful meaning and relevance for everyone in this room today. That's why we're looking at it. We're not just here to have an ancient history lesson, look at a big chunk of the Bible and say, well, very interesting that all of those things happened. This is for us. There is an escape that we need to make as well. So if you're new or if you haven't been around over the last few weeks, let me bring you up to speed with where we are. Remember, all the previous messages can easily be accessed through the church website, and that's a good way of keeping in touch. Again, whatever the ending of this story is going to be, the setting is anything but feel good. The prisoners here are the nation of Israel, slaves in the land of Egypt. We've seen in the story over the last few weeks how their leaders, Moses and Aaron, acting under God's instructions, have been confronting Pharaoh, the king, with the demand to let the people go. Initially, politely, and with words alone, but then, as Pharaoh will not yield, the words have been backed up with plagues sent by God against him and against his nation. And so, in a different sense, escape has also appeared on the agenda of the Egyptians. They're on the receiving end of this increasingly severe sequence of plagues. They don't know this, but there will be 10 of these plagues in all. Plagues that are an assault against the pride and power of Egypt and its gods. And plagues that are a sign that points to God and his character and his own majestic agenda. Because remember, these plagues are not some random show of force on the part of God. They're not random. They're not just there to twist Pharaoh's arm. Just before the beginning of the plagues, the Lord explains just what he's out to do in this key verse, chapter 7, verse 5. We've kept coming back to this. The Lord God says, "The Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand against Egypt and bring the Israelites out of it. They will know that I am the Lord." And over 3 weeks, we're looking at plagues 1 to 9. So far, we got up to number 6. And we've seen how that divine agenda is being put into effect. God has said what he's going to do, and he's doing it. When we looked at the first three plagues, the blood, the frogs, and the gnats, we saw how Pharaoh's sorcerers, the magicians, are eventually forced to recognize that what is going on is beyond their power and beyond their comprehension. In chapter 8, verse 19, they came out with that realization that this is the finger of God. God's purposes are working out. They are beginning to see. And last week, as we looked at the plague of flies, the plague on livestock, and the plague of boils, we saw how God now introduces a division, a separation between what's happening to the Egyptians and what happens to the Israelites. The vicious flies, the blood-sucking flies, are everywhere in Egypt. But in Goshen, where the Israelites live, they are nowhere to be seen. The Egyptian fields are strewn with animal carcasses, but in Goshen, not a cow, a sheep, or donkey has so much as sneezed. The text describes it as a sign for Pharaoh especially, that God is going to rescue these people. They will make good their escape, and Pharaoh must not stand in the way. And yet, of course, Pharaoh does just that. The story says his heart was hardened. He is resistant to God. He will not hear and he will not yield to him. So last time we were looking at the anatomy of a hardened heart, the life that says no to God, and the warning this gives to us of where a hardened heart will eventually take us. Well, that brings us to today. This morning we're looking at plagues 7 to 9. This is a long passage, we've read it, and we're not looking at everything in this story, we'd be here all day, but let's quickly work through it before we focus on its main message. And it begins with the Lord calling Moses once again. Look at chapter 9, verse 13. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Get up early in the morning, confront Pharaoh and say to him, 'This is what the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, says. Let my people go so that they may worship me, or this time I will send the full force of my plagues against you and against your officials and your people, so that you may know that there is no one like me in all the earth. For by now I could have stretched out my hand and struck you and your people with a plague that would have wiped you off the earth.'" The start of this triplet of plagues, like the others, will be marked by confronting Pharaoh in the morning, presumably down by the river again. The core message to let the people go is repeated, but in the warning that follows, there is a new tone. The Lord is saying, "Pharaoh, you ain't seen nothing yet. You thought that was bad. This Nile where you're standing turned to blood. Your livestock slaughtered. The painful disease you've just experienced. That was nothing to this. So far, you haven't seen more than a tiny fraction of my power." Moses will continue by warning Pharaoh of a terrible hailstorm, violence from the sky, unprecedented in that 2,000 years of Egyptian history have seen nothing like it. This will be the ultimate weather statistic. But there's still a chance to escape. You've got one day to get everything under cover. There's a chance to respond. Do the Egyptians listen? Well, some of them do. Verse 20, "Those officials of Pharaoh who feared the word of the Lord hurried to bring their slaves and their livestock inside. But those who ignored the word of the Lord left their slaves and livestock in the fields." You see how it all turns on whether they believe the word of the Lord or not. It always does. The warnings have convinced some of them, but not all. So now the hailstorm strikes. We've seen pictures of violent hailstorms recently. This is far worse. Rain sluices down. Thunder rolls constantly. Lightning flashes across the sky in a remarkable way. It's described as fire, literally. Huge hailstones hammer down remorselessly. Tree branches are smashed and broken off. Crops that are showing above ground are beaten flat. People and animals that are out and about will be destroyed. People are dying now. This plague is the first one that's explicitly lethal, and just one area is exempt. Goshen, where the Israelites are living, is spared from the hail. A visible sign of what the Lord is doing. Pharaoh pleads for a respite, promising to let Israel go, and Moses says he will pray. In fact, there's a half-hidden miracle in verse 29 and verse 33. Do you see it? Moses himself can walk freely in and out of the city in the middle of this lethal hailstorm. He's in the open, and he lives to tell the tale. But as soon as the hail relents, Pharaoh goes back to square one. His heart is hard, his own authority reasserted, his eyes closed to the evidence of what God is doing. The next plague will swiftly follow. Look at the start of chapter 10. "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Go to Pharaoh, for I have hardened his heart and the hearts of his officials, so that I may perform these signs of mine among them, that you may tell your children and grandchildren how I dealt harshly with the Egyptians and how I performed my signs among them, and that you may know that I am the Lord's.'" We're left in no doubt about what God is up to. For the second time in today's passage, he lays it out in detail. God declares he's showing himself, demonstrating his power and his rule, not just to the Egyptians, but to the Israelites as well. "I will show you, you may know that I am the Lord's." His own people too must be clear about his character and his glory. this reference to dealing harshly might give us the impression God is being unfair or vicious, but the original word doesn't really carry that tone. It means something more like, I have made a toy out of Egypt. I have proved my supremacy over them. And that is exactly what God is doing. So again, there is a warning, and this time another clear opportunity for Pharaoh to relent. Chapter 10, verse 4. And then the locusts are announced. Now, we know roughly what time of year this is happening from the note about the crops in the previous chapter. It's probably around March now, the time of year when the sun gets stronger and the warm sand hatches the eggs of the locust out in the desert where they've lain buried in the sand. Egypt is used to locust invasions. To this day, they're a scourge in certain parts of Africa, but never on this scale. Whatever was left by the hail, from the green mush of the crops that were pulped to the last leaf on the trees that are still standing, is going to be consumed. And Pharaoh's officials speak up. Verse 7, Pharaoh's officials said to him, how long will this man be a snare to us? Let the people go, so that they may worship the Lord their God. Do you not yet realize that Egypt is ruined? Now, this is no way to speak to your Pharaoh. This is the man who all your life you have believed is God. And he certainly views himself as one. Well, perhaps by now they're not quite so sure. They don't wait for the locusts to appear to say this. They are catching on. They know it will happen. So Pharaoh recalls Moses and Aaron and tries once more to negotiate. What if I let the men go and keep the women and children back? After all, worship and sacrifice is men's business, isn't it? Not a chance, says Moses. We're all going. Not let us go now, but we will go. He knows. Pharaoh's response to that is deeply ironic. In verse 10, Pharaoh said, the Lord be with you if I let you go, along with your women and children. Clearly, you're bent on evil. What Pharaoh means is, on your bike, Moses. But of course, we know that his words are literally true. The Lord is with Moses, and Pharaoh will let them go. And so, right on cue, the locusts are blown in on the east wind that the Lord sends. They arrive in their billions, so that the ground is black with them. You actually can't see the ground. It is a moving, writhing carpet of black, and nothing is left alive when they've finished. Again, Pharaoh appears to relent, and again, Moses prays, and the locusts are blown away, every last one. But with the threat removed, Pharaoh reasserts his control over his devastated and denuded land. This land now brought to its knees, where starvation is now imminent, and still refuses to let the people go. No warning is given for plague number 9. This time it's extremely simple. It's going to get dark. Verse 21, and the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hands towards the sky so that darkness spreads over Egypt. Darkness that can be felt. So Moses stretched out his hand towards the sky and total darkness covered all Egypt for 3 days. No one could see anyone else or move about for 3 days, yet all the Israelites had light in the places where they lived. To us, this may not seem so terrible. A bit of dark, yeah? But consider this. Not only do these people have nothing like electricity to light up their homes and their cities, the text gives the impression that they are unable even to light a lamp or a candle. It's a strange kind of darkness. It is not like an ordinary night time. Darkness is so thick that you can feel it. Beyond even that, this darkness is the supreme challenge to the chief of all the Egyptian gods, Amon-Ra, the sun gods. Every morning as the sun rose, they would worship Ra for defeating the forces of darkness and chaos and bringing light to the world again. But now, as darkness reigns day after day, the utter impotence of their greatest God is fully demonstrated. The blessing of light is in the Lord's hands, and he has withdrawn it. Oh, except in one area. On his people in Goshen, the sun shines as brightly and as gladly as ever. While Egypt is hemmed in by a wall of terrifying darkness, somehow Moses is summoned and makes his way to the palace. This may actually be after the darkness has lifted. We can't be sure. Another attempt at negotiation by Pharaoh, rejected by Moses, and again his heart is hard. And in fury, Pharaoh drives Moses away and warns him never to return. It's a death threat, but his words are empty. Moses says, verse 29, just as you say, Moses replied, I will never appear before you again. Now, as we know, there is one more plague to go, and Moses does, in fact, appear to announce it. But it's quite possible that he announces the last plague here and now, before he leaves Pharaoh's presence. So that as far as he can tell, his words to Pharaoh are true. Be that as it may, the darkness that Egypt has just experienced is a terrible prelude to the 10th and deadliest plague, which we'll start to look at next week with Simon. The darkness points to final judgments. And that is highlighted by one of the words that is used in verse 22. The ordinary word for darkness is combined with another word that is used repeatedly by the Old Testament prophets when they are speaking of God's final judgment on the world. And we'll just look at one of them in Zephaniah chapter 1, which is a difficult book to find, and I'll give you a clue. It's on page 944, if you want to turn to it with me. Zephaniah chapter 1, from verse 14. And this is warning about, this is judgment day. This is the language of judgment day. The great day of the Lord is near, near and coming quickly. The cry on the day of the Lord is bitter. The mighty warrior shouts his battle cry. That day will be a day of wrath, a day of distress and anguish, a day of trouble and ruin, a day of darkness and gloom, a day of clouds and blackness, a day of trumpet and battle cry against the fortified cities and against the corner towers. I will bring such distress on all people that they will grope about like those who are blind because they have sinned against the Lord. You see, the Lord bringing this deep and impenetrable darkness on the world represents his wrath and his judgment against rebellious humanity. It's unmistakable. And in the New Testament as well, darkness is described in the context of judgments. We glanced at this passage in Revelation a couple of weeks ago, but here is Revelation 16, verses 10 and 11. The fifth angel poured out his bowl on the throne of the beast, and its kingdom was plunged into darkness. And people gnawed their tongues in agony and cursed the God of heaven because of their pains and their sores, but they refused to repent of what they had done. The kingdom of the beast there is the realm of rebellion against the rule of Almighty God, just exactly what Egypt stands for in Exodus. This darkness on Egypt prefigures and pictures the final judgment, God's wrath poured out on the world, the great day of reckoning that we may well not want to think about, but which we will have to face, because the Bible assures us it is coming. It is coming as surely as the plagues came on Egypt. As Moses assures Pharaoh that they will, and they do, as surely as the paralyzing darkness engulfs Pharaoh's realm, so God's judgment will come to this world that has rejected him. So the question for us, the urgent, the desperately important question is simply this. With final judgment on its way, who can escape? Who would escape in Egypt? Who will escape on that final day? And in the time that remains now, briefly, we're going to try to answer that question from the Bible. Who can escape? Who will it be? Three things to say about this great escape. First, the choice is the Lord's. The choice is the Lord's. And immediately we hit the reality that many find so difficult to accept. Remember how throughout the story we have observed Pharaoh's hard heart as he has reasserted his own authority and repeatedly tried to negotiate and strike bargains with the Lord. At the end of last week's passage, we came to this in chapter 9, verse 12. But the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he would not listen to Moses and Aaron, just as the Lord had said to Moses. And we said that this was the Lord's response to Pharaoh's own stubborn refusal to submit to the Lord. But the Bible also wants us to see this in another way. So look on a few verses more into today's passage, and verses 15 and 16. God says to Pharaoh, "For by now I could have stretched out my hand and struck you and your people with a plague that would have wiped you off the earth, but I have raised you up for this very purpose, that I might show you my power and that my name might be proclaimed in all the earth." You see, all the time that Pharaoh has been busily rejecting the Lord, he has been following the path laid out for him by the same Lord. Look at what God said to Moses way back before he even returned to Egypt and met Pharaoh for the very first time. Chapter 4, verse 21. The Lord said to Moses, "When you return to Egypt, see that you perform before Pharaoh all the wonders I have given you the power to do, but I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go." The Lord's purpose from the beginning is that Pharaoh will not respond. And he has preserved him instead of destroying him up to this point in today's story for this very reason, to show his power and to display his own glory. That is God's agenda in all this. Now, the New Testament, written 1,500 years later, picks up on this story of Pharaoh and takes it even a bit further. This is what Paul has to say when he writes to the church in Rome, Romans chapter 9. Verses 14 to 18. Paul says, "What then shall we say? Is God unjust? Not at all, for he says to Moses, 'I will have mercy on whom I have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I have compassion.' It does not therefore depend on human desire or effort, but on God's mercy. For Scripture says to Pharaoh, 'I raised you up for this very purpose, that I might display my power in you, and that my name might be proclaimed in all the earth.' Therefore, God has mercy on whom he wants to have mercy, and he hardens whom he wants to harden." And you see the quote of our verse 16 there. Paul is talking about salvation here. And it's very clear from what he says and illustrates from Pharaoh's story that God does call or elect certain people to be saved, to be rescued from that final darkness, and others he does not. Pharaoh's role in God's plan is not to be saved, not to be rescued, not to turn and respond to the Lord. His role is to be an object lesson for the power and glory of the Lord. And yes, this is hard for us to understand. And if you're new to this whole idea of needing to escape from God's judgment, this bit of it, election, no doubt seems particularly weird. I know that. I get that. This is difficult. All I can add for now is what Paul goes on to say in Romans, that we have to remember that God is God. He is in a completely unique position, and he has every right to do as he pleases with us as part of his creation. He promises that he will be just, and he promises to exercise mercy. And that may still leave us with questions and objections, so please do come and talk to me afterwards and take me on. I'm more than happy for that. We had a couple of very good questions and discussions after the service last week. But look at it this way, and this should help. The force of that passage in Romans is this. What ultimately decides that I'm going to be saved is not anything good in me. There is nothing at all that I can be proud of. I can't even boast that I was smart enough to decide to follow Christ. Not even that is to my credit. It's all about the Lord's, his decision, his grace, his election, not conditioned on anything at all in me. And actually, when we understand salvation this way, the doctrine of election is wonderful. And it is something that will keep us humble, and it will keep us grateful, and it will make us glad. And if you are a Christian, let's rejoice in the truth of the Lord's choice. Because he's chosen me, before I ever thought of choosing him, he's going to keep hold of me. He's never going to drop me. He's never going to let me slip. However bad things get, nothing can ever again separate me from his love, because it all started with him. So, who can escape? The choice is the Lord's. Secondly, however, the responsibility is ours. The responsibility is ours. You see, this truth about the Lord's sovereign choice does not mean that Pharaoh isn't responsible for what he does. Not at all. Look at the next couple of verses in our story, 17 and 18. You still set yourself against my people and will not let them go. Therefore, at this time tomorrow, I will send the worst hailstorm that has ever fallen on Egypt from the day it was founded till now. Clearly, the Lord, through Moses, is still holding Pharaoh responsible for his actions. You still set yourself. You will not let. Alongside that awesome truth of God's election, his choice, make no mistake, we are absolutely responsible for our sin and rebellion against God. No one can blame God for their sin. We have to hold these two truths together. God's sovereign choice and real human responsibility. The Bible always does hold them together. And if we say, but I don't get that, I can't get my head around how both those things can be true at the same time, that's okay. Yes, it is mysterious. But leave that to God to sort out. He will, anyway. He's God. And surely we shouldn't expect fully to understand the mind of God. Should we? Wouldn't there be something wrong if we thought we could? Look on to chapter 10, verses 3 and 4. I won't read them, but look at the way Moses challenges Pharaoh again. How long will you do this if you do that? Pharaoh is not regarded as some kind of robot acting rigidly according to his programming, and neither are we. So how does he exercise that responsibility? Well, look at chapter 9 from verse 27. Then Pharaoh summoned Moses and Aaron. The hail is falling all around them, hammering on the roof. This time I have sinned, he said to them. The Lord is in the right, and I and my people are in the wrong. Pray to the Lord, for we've had enough thunder and hail. I'm sure you have. I will let you go. You don't have to stay any longer. Moses replied, when I have gone out of the city, I will spread out my hands in prayer to the Lord. The thunder will stop, and there will be no more hail, so you may know that the earth is the Lord's. But I know that you and your officials still do not fear the Lord God. And verse 34, when Pharaoh saw that the rain and hail and thunder had stopped, he sinned again. He and his officials hardened their hearts. So Pharaoh's heart was hard, and he would not let the Israelites go, just as the Lord had said through Moses. You see, the language Pharaoh uses is great. Seems so genuine. He's talking about sinning and the Lord and right and wrong and praying and pushing all the right buttons, isn't he? He's got all the right words in that little speech. But as soon as the pressure is off, he reverts. He shows that his response was never genuine. Once the situation eases, he has no real response to the Lord at all. And of course, the Lord knows that from the beginning. That's why Moses says, I know you still don't fear the Lord. And what a terrible warning this is, that someone can speak like this, use such language, appear so repentant, apparently yield so completely to the Lord, and yet be so false. What does this mean for us? Well, this is a striking picture of what we could call the crisis Christian. Someone who, under great pressure, will cry out to God, get me out of this and I will follow you. I'll believe in you. I'll serve you. Or at some period of intense pressure, they will start coming to church and even learning to use the right kind of words. singing the songs and acting as if they were really a Christian and committed to the Lord. But then once the situation gets easier, it all evaporates like dew on this morning's grass. And there is nothing genuine at all. And I have to challenge you with this, myself as well. Could this possibly be you? Are you a crisis Christian? Praying, responding, coming to church, reading the Bible, just when the pressure is on and you're worried and you feel you need all the help you can get. You may even think it's genuine, but in reality, there is no change of heart, no love for God. And pretty soon, like hail on the ground, it all disappears. Be warned, because the Lord knows what is really in our hearts. He is not fooled by our language, and he is not mocked. He wants to offer you the reality of living for him, not the pretense. Don't fool yourself, and don't think you can fool the Lord. Who can escape? The responsibility is ours. And thirdly, the way is Jesus Christ. The way is Jesus Christ. You see, Pharaoh's story doesn't hold out a lot of hope, but there is something in this story that does give us hope. Remember that division, that separation between Egypt and the Lord's own people. Think of that ninth plague again, that all-enveloping darkness. Chapter 10, verse 22. So Moses stretched out his hand towards the sky, and total darkness covered all Egypt for 3 days. No one could see anyone else or move about for 3 days. Yet all the Israelites had light in the places where they lived. Deep darkness all over Egypt, but where Israel lives, where God's people live, there is this wonderful light instead. So how can we escape from darkness, from this judgment of God into light? So far, we haven't got an answer, but here it is. The answer is that there would come someone who would experience and endure that darkness for us. Someone who would bear the effects of the darkness in himself and lift it from off us and give us light instead. And this is exactly what Jesus Christ came to do. It was a horrifying prospect he had to face. With the horror of the cross before him, Jesus prays to God in words that almost echo Pharaoh here. Chapter 10, 17. Literally, Pharaoh wants to plead with God, remove this death from me. And here is Jesus in Matthew 26, verse 39, praying before the cross. He fell with his face to the ground and prayed, my Father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me. Yet not as I will, but as you will. Unlike Pharaoh, Jesus submits to the will of God. That cup is another picture of God's judgment. The cup filled with his wrath against sin. Drinking that cup means receiving and experiencing his terrible judgment. And Jesus is faced with doing just that for all of us. And then on the cross, as Jesus is nailed up and hangs there between earth and sky, we hear this, Matthew 27, verse 45. From noon until 3 PM, darkness came over all the land. Not for 3 days, but for 3 hours, this supernatural darkness descends, centered on the cross as the wrath of God falls on his divine Son. As Jesus becomes the substitute and takes the judgment due to millions upon millions of us whom he plans to rescue. And Jesus went into the darkness for us so that we could have light, so that we could see, so that the path of escape, the pathway to eternal life now shines bright and clear before us. The way of escape is Jesus Christ, out of the darkness and into the light. Have you found that way? If not, you can find it today. Don't worry about whether you're chosen by God or not. If you come to him, you can be sure that he has chosen and called you. And he will welcome you with wide open, loving arms. Darkness is already on the horizon. day is coming. If you are not trusting in Jesus Christ, it will engulf you forever. And there is a way of escape, only one. Recognize who you really are. God is there. You are accountable to Him, and you have failed to live the way that He calls us to live. Look at yourself and then look at Jesus Christ, who hung in the darkness, taking God's judgment, paying the price so that you could come into the light. And ask Him to forgive you, launch you into a new life, a new start, and a different eternity. Let's just reflect on this for a moment. I'm aware there's been a lot in this passage that we've looked at this morning. And again, I say I'm very willing to pick up on anything I've said after the service. But don't miss the main message. Please don't miss that. There is a darkness coming that will engulf you without Jesus Christ.